we haven't done a single podcast about Britney Spears.
You know? None. Oh, nothing.
It's true, man.
I think this is the first time we've even mentioned her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe it could be a whole intersection of Henry Darger and Britney Spears. Like the
Britney Darger.
That would be an intersection.
Henry Spears.
Like a buddy cop movie of the two of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Buddy cop movie. Britney Spears and Henry Darger.
Yes.
Yeah.
Keep Darger away from Britney. He's kind of a freak.
Yeah, no, it was gonna be more of a psychological horror.
There was a land of deserts and of ancient site and cobblestone streets that were winding through marketplaces where the ancient Babylonians developed algebra. They were able to do calculations in an algorithmic fashion. These ancient people developed formulas to calculate solutions for problems typically solved today using linear equations. So, from ancient Babylon, we have the roots of what eventually became the basis for the internet, and over time, led to the development of the encoding of sound waves into ones and zeros, and then into podcasts. Out of these millions of podcasts, three yahoos started another one in a shed near a glacially formed lake known as Maspinock. I'm Matt Carl.
I'm Normal Andy.
I'm producer Chris.
And we have a linguist here, and he should really have done the intro because I totally screwed it up. Crack a beer.
All right.
Nice.
Well, I have to say I think linguist is the wrong term.
Well, you are sort of. My degrees are in cognitive science.
Oh, sorry. But
I publish in linguistics journals, and I'm a chair of a linguistics department. But I'm also a psychologist under some, and I also do neuroscience. I'm cognitive science. It's a pretty broad thing, and it has science in the name, so you know it's science. Just in case you were confused about it.
Cognitive science, it's the MacGyver of degrees.
Yes, right, exactly. Right.
So Matt, can you, I have a question for you actually relating to this intro is, I wrote it down and it sounded like intelligent in my head, and then I didn't look at it from, I wrote it down like riffing off of some weird algebra thing, and then I didn't look at it for a whole week. And then when I read it, it all of a sudden made no sense. Oh, well.
I was kind of digging on it. It made some sense to me, actually. You know?
Oh, good, like, good.
Yeah. No, it's there's all this like non-Western sources of so much mathematics, and it's not just back to the Babylonians, but like the... the Arab civilizations of Europe was in the Dark Ages, right? That was like high time for astronomy and algebra. Algebra is actually like a corruption of this Arab mathematician's. Oh no, sorry, it's a treatise he wrote. Has Al-Jabbar in it, which is
My god,
the Arabic word for completion. It's like when you balance an equation. That's what the treatise was about. It sounds like a riveting treatise. It's basically how to solve really simple algebraic equations. But, back then that was like really serious stuff.
We take it for granted much nowadays. Totally. I mean, you think about it. There was no geometry once. There was no algebra once.
Yeah.
And it's really, I can't think of, you can't, maybe you could work retail without knowing algebra. But you certainly can't manage retail without knowing algebra.
Yeah.
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
There's really very little that you can do if you don't know algebra.
Totally. And it's not intuitive. I'm sure to some people it's intuitive, but it's not intuitive to just invent if nobody's ever done it before. You know,
My wife always talks about when she was learning algebra for the first time, she was just angry at the idea of a variable. She's like, well, if x equals 2, why don't you just put a 2 in the equation? Like, why do you have this x thing? I don't understand. But it is definitely useful. I think we can all agree on
that. But, you know, I mean, as we talk about this more, I wonder, like, what is algebra something that people were doing already and someone codified it? Which is a huge thing. I'm not putting that, you know, diminishing what he did at all. But is that something that, you know, well, like I just said, geometry. Stonehenge was built without people knowing what geometry was.
Right.
People were doing that. And I think with algebra as well, that if someone was just kind of like, hey, we're missing so many bushels of grain.
Right.
How many are we missing? You know, you're doing algebra.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I think abstraction is the whole, like, that's what they're like, oh, it doesn't just apply to bushels, but I could imagine applying to cans of beer or, you know, whatever other type of thing you
want. If I have three cans of beer and I take one away. Yeah. No, I think it's like everything else. It's like, as soon as money is involved or trading is involved and you think you're getting screwed, you learn it quick or you think outside the box. You know what I mean? Right. So somebody probably was like, oh, I think Joe screwed me over on those bushels of flour, whatever, who knows what the hell. You know what I mean? Like, and so they figured it out. They figured it out so they didn't get screwed over. And then the nerds took over once they, and they were like, hey, you know, they started thinking more outside the box, you know, like,
right. Yeah. Yep.
I like that Stonehenge. I mean, was there written language when they built Stonehenge? Probably not.
Not that they left behind.
I think the thinking on written language, from what I understand, is like it was invented probably just 2 or 3 times in human history. Definitely in like Babylonia, like in sort of the ancient Middle Eastern civilizations, and also the Maya invented writing sort of totally independently. And then it's a question about all the other writing systems. Are they just like basically people copying the Sumerians or the Babylonians, if that was then there was the whole, you know, invention of the alphabet, and that was something that was just once that people figured that out.
So basically a move from pictograms to phonetics with that.
Well, first it was like start off with pictograms, you know, it's just like a rebus kind of, you know. It was going to the rebus principle to be like, oh, if I draw a picture of an eye, that could also mean I as in the first person singular, you know, sound the same. And so that's where people started. And then they had like alphabets that were just syllables, like different symbols would be whole syllables. Right. But then getting to like individual letters, that was really probably something that happened in the Near East with the Phoenicians and the other like civilizations trading with Egypt and stuff.
Okay.
Speaking of nerding out,
I love it, cool
stuff at the Oriental Institute in Chicago has like had a big exhibit on that I was at. And
nice.
Yeah.
I don't even want to interrupt you with the plague facts. Do you think, Matt, can you pull a plague fact out? But I have to put the stinger on if you can.
Yeah, no, Chris.
We have one that's actually, it is directly related to the University of Chicago again.
That's right.
Okay, hold off.
Bring out your dead. Bring out your dead.
Bring out your plague facts. Bring out your plague facts.
Okay, so like most people, most reasonable people, you know, Matt and I like to know when is the most recent nearby plague infection that has happened
Oh, totally.
In our neighborhood.
It's, yeah, it's, yeah.
You know, oh. I mean, it's not so bad that you get plague weather reports in the morning anymore. But, you know, you do want to keep track of things. So we were looking it up and trying to find the closest plague incident to us. And it actually was in 2009.
Oh, my God.
And it was right here in Chicago. There was someone who died of the plague. And
dang.
It was Malcolm Kasadabam Ban.
Spoilers.
Yes. Yeah. And but he was actually a lab worker at the University of Chicago. And he was an associate professor of molecular genetics and cell biology and microbiology at the University of Chicago. And yeah, in a laboratory accident, he caught the plague and died.
Oh, that sucks.
That's like the worst superhero origin I've ever heard.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, and I think it also serves as a really good cautionary tale for Carl as well. Yeah.
Apparently, it's they think that what contributed to it is that he had a hereditary condition of iron overload.
Oh, shit, I got that. I mean,
Uh-oh. Step one, Carl.
Yeah. You know,
how'd he get the plague?
He was in a lab.
Yeah, there's a lab accident.
Yeah.
What does that have to do with the iron overload?
Well, it says here that the strain that he got had never been known to infect anyone because it was weakened. And apparently, his condition, it was weakened specifically around its sensitivity to iron. And so he had the condition that was like the perfect breeding ground for this. This is like all coming from Wikipedia, so just to be clear.
So it's completely factual.
Yes. So you know, I wanted to say that, you know, my I got my mom the 23andMe thing for a couple birthdays ago. She's super excited about it. And something that really got me out of that was that I found out there's like I'm one of the like higher Neanderthal genetic components among people. Yeah. Or assuming I haven't been tested, but my mother is part Neanderthal.
Well,
so we have to be.
Yeah. What percent? We're way into the Neanderthals.
I know. I figured I should bring it up. I can't remember. I should text her and ask what percentage she is.
I mean, I think I'm like, 53%. There's like, not 53% Neanderthal, but in, like I think like you can get like up to 3 or 4% Neanderthal. So I'm like in the 53 percentile. That's what I mean. Of Europeans.
Right? Okay.
It's mostly Europeans who are. And speaking of Neanderthals, Matt, you ever wonder what a Neanderthal sounds like?
I have totally wondered that. Do you have like a sample of what it's like?
Yeah. I have a clip to play, and it kind of starts a little bit in the middle where this lady is. I guess she's a linguist. Don't quote me on that. Last time I called somebody a linguist, they bit my head off, and it was about 5 minutes ago. No, I'm only kidding.
It was 15 minutes ago.
Yeah, right. She's working with a voice guy, a voice actor, and she's trying to figure out how a Neanderthal sounds. And the part that we're missing in this clip is she looks at these two, like, I don't know if they're voice boxes or the shapes of their throats, and like a human compared to a Neanderthal, and the Neanderthal is different. So here it is.
As well as his vocal tract, our Neanderthal's strange shape would also have affected his voice. His deep rib cage, a large and heavy skull, and most of all, a huge nasal cavity.
Let's just add a bit of nasal now.
1, 2, 3!
Now, the other thing that would be happening, which would actually increase that quality, is a very heavy skull that seems to pull down into the throat there. Now, add to that the fact that they had a fantastic chest, which is a support system of breath, which can produce enormous chest resonance and tremendous power. So I imagine that they wouldn't have subtle sounds. It would be loud, very loud, or very, very loud. And we can try and get that by... I'm now going to engage Elliot by... push into me. This is actually getting him right into his body. Now speak.
One, two, three!
Now let's make a sound. Just let's make a huge R. And again.
All right, that's it.
Wow.
And,
wow.
So the skeleton...
I mean, that must be why they were killed off.
That's I was thinking the same thing.
It's like, shut up, man. God.
Yeah.
It's so loud.
They're hiding in a cave, you know, and they just, it just yeah, freaking right. echoes.
You need to be quiet.
Shush! They'll find us!
They all sounded like Gollum. Schmeagle! shit. All right, so that didn't work. My Neanderthal thing didn't really work too well, but whatever. We can move on. have you guys heard about the I don't know if this was in Chicago. It might have I keep thinking Chicago, but it might have been actually England.
of course. Yeah.
But, it's cool. Always one or the other.
Right.
But with plagues like typhoid. There was like a typhoid plague and it was in the water, and this one group of people didn't get it, and they were all working at a brewery and all they drank was beer. So like they, it was pure there, but they didn't, this was before they knew about, sterilizing water, you know, but
But I think that was, who was the scientist? It was Victorian London.
There
was the guy who really, he invented the whole field. That's, we're kind of on this whole thing of inventing fields of science. Today. But he basically mapped out where there were cases of cholera.
Yeah, that was it. Cholera, sorry.
He tagged them to wells, and that's how they figured out that the cholera was in the water. And the thing was, they basically had septic systems in London at that time, but basically an apartment building, everything just went down into a huge cistern, like in the basement or, you know, under the street right in front of the building. And those then would leak out. And if you had a leaky sewage cistern that was close to a well, it was leaking sewage into the well water, and that's what was causing cholera to spread.
Yeah.
And I want to say Snow, who was the guy, I forget
who was the
but basically he just took a map of London and was kind of like, here are all the cases of cholera and where, what wells did these people get their water from. And he totally
John Snow.
Yes.
Yeah. I was gonna say,
and then of course we know where, what he went on to do after that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He resurrected himself from the dead, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah. Slept with his sister.
Yeah.
And that was a good thing. I mean, that was the whole point of being a Targaryen, right? Is your sister.
That's the whole thing. So George Martin really just has this thing for his sister.
And
coming up to justify a scenario, right, or come up with a scenario that would justify them being together. Yeah.
Right, but I mean, George Martin, have you seen what he looks like? Imagine what his sister looks like. I mean,
stick to calling people linguists.
Jon Snow invented public health. Like, that was like the... And it was very data driven, right? Pretty amazing stuff.
He's a genius.
Nice.
We kind of got off track when I put the freaking Neanderthal thing on.
What track were we on?
I think we're on a track of people who invented things and things that we take for granted now, and someone had to either create a framework for them or codify them or even clarify the concepts.
you know? This is really is getting into cognitive science in a lot of ways. Right. But it's kind of like, it's an ongoing thing. And like, what is the future going to bring?
Right.
Right.
Oh, right.
I mean, this all relates to kind of, I'm working on this job that I can't really talk about, but.
Great.
It's kind of, a lot of things it's dealing with is like establishing a civilization, basically. So, like creating written language and organizing society and stuff like that.
Is it like a video game?
No, it's a TV show that's going to be on the air in a few years, probably.
Cool.
Yeah, but it's a comedy, so it's not like, you know, that stuff's in the background, basically.
Right. Okay, okay, but you want to make it as realistic as possible. I'm
kind of.
Yeah. Perfect.
I don't know if this has anything to do with anything, Matt, but I wanted to throw this at you.
The duck.
So have you heard of the Chinese Room?
Yeah. Yes.
You have.
Oh, I haven't heard of the Chinese
Room. What is this?
All right.
I mean, it has to do with AI and you know, the Turing test?
Yeah.
It has
to
do with the Turing test.
I know the Turing test in Uncanny Valley. That's where my knowledge stops.
Well, do you want to explain to the listener what the Turing test is, just in case they don't know?
Well, maybe Matt can explain. Okay. So the Turing test is this is from what I gather. The Turing test is, so we want to, so Turing, who was a famous mathematician in a long time ago.
And he was also in Chicago or England.
Yeah, he was in England, I think.
And he
was famous in World War II, like a code breaker type. I think he broke the Enigma code. And he invented this thing like called the Turing test, which is to figure out. They use it like it's basically, if you get a chat bot, you want to. It is to figure out if a robot is cognitive, has a
awareness.
So the Turing test is if a robot can convince a human that it's real, that it's a real person, then they've become aware, I guess. Right. Matt,
It started from Turing being like, the article starts off like, so we want to design a, you know, an artificial intelligence. What is intelligence? And he's like, I don't know, but how about this? We just give people, you know, we have people do this test where they communicate with someone, and it could be a person and it could be a machine. And if the person can't tell which is which, then it must be intelligent. That was the
right
of artificial intelligence.
Just explained it way better than I did. Thank you.
Not to be confused with the void comp test.
No, that's that's a much more sensitive measure that I don't believe has been developed yet, or maybe but look, coming, that's also part of this show that's coming out, right, that you're going to be working on?
No, probably not.
Too bad. We could use a good test of artificial intelligence. So that was Turing in his way of trying to get around the hard problem of saying what counts as intelligent, you know, just to say, well, practically speaking, if it acts intelligent, then it must be intelligent.
Right. And so then everybody's like trying to like shoot it down and throwing stuff back and forth. And then somebody comes up with this thing called the Chinese Room. Which is, and maybe you can, I'll try, want me to try to explain it again? You can explain it better afterwards.
So that's great.
So in the inside of this room, we'll say he's an English speaker, and he doesn't know a lick of Chinese, and he has a book with all a bunch of Chinese symbols in there. And the book says, if you see these symbols, you write the a bunch of other symbols, corresponding with those, right? So then a Chinese speaker is outside the room and starts writing questions to the Chinese room, and then puts it through a slot, and the guy grabs the paper and he sees a bunch of Chinese symbols. He can't speak Chinese, but he takes the symbols and he looks up in his book what to reply to, and he replies with a bunch of other Chinese symbols, and he puts it out. And so that, like, the person on the outs, the Chinese speaker on the outside of the room, may be fooled. You know what I mean? That's
right. Like, okay, so they don't know that the other person doesn't speak Chinese.
Yeah. But then there was an argument to this, like, that said it doesn't matter if the guy in the room who has the book translate doesn't know Chinese. The whole system is intelligent. So I don't know. Matt, do you have anything to say to
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a it's one of these famous puzzles in philosophy of mind that and like most philosophy of mind, it kind of turns around questions like, do you feel like this is intelligence? And if you're like, no, it doesn't, then that's an argument. If you think it is, then that's good. Yeah. So, but it's meant as like it's like a thought experiment to try and get you to just be like, well, no, I mean, come on. Like, the room doesn't know Chinese. I mean, come on, it doesn't know anything. It's just a guy looking up symbols. And that's, I think that, I think that's still happening right now, because a lot of the state of the art language technology, you know, that has really done like amazing things in the past 10, 15 years is kind of similar in that it doesn't know. It's hard to think of it as these computer programs as knowing anything. All that they know is how words relate to other words. They never interact with the world. They never like manipulate anything. All they do is just like change characters around. That's all that. And so, so they're not. And if you look at what they sometimes say, it doesn't make any sense. So that's
right.
Maybe just that first impression, you're like, yeah, that does not know what's going on. So yeah, I think it's a convincing argument in some ways. Where people have gone with it is to really go to this idea that being like embodied in the world is really critical for intelligence. Like being a brain in a vat, it's kind of like the Chinese room. Okay. The Chinese room like doesn't interact with the world, it doesn't manipulate anything. And so maybe what's really key for a truly general artificial intelligence is that it has to like be a physical thing that interacts with the world in some way. So maybe physical robots could be intelligent, but disembodied computer programs can never be intelligent. That's kind of one perspective that people have on the
problem. They do have AI programs that evolve in the way, I know that the way some people like solved like problems, like there was another AI program where these I think it was students, they wanted to make like a bunch of ants, like computer generated ants, find the food the most efficient way possible. So they wrote 10 programs, and the best programmed ant, they took that and wrote 10 more programs, and then they just kept evolving it, and eventually evolved into like a perfect colony of ants that could find the food. You know what I mean? Like, so does that mean we're like, because of like, to me, that's like,
yeah,
like evolution. Does that mean we're just evolved? Like evolution just does all this crazy tests, and then eventually through, some sort of intelligence, like intelligence of trial and error, it becomes like the best thing, you know. I don't know.
That's so here's another philosophy of mind thing to chew on, which is related to that, which is imagine that there's a swamp. This is like something that has been written up in papers, so it's not like I'm not just making this up, I swear.
Right.
There's a swamp, and through this like very complex process, a whole bunch of particles accidentally come together and form a copy of you that's like physically identical to you in every way.
Like Ship of Theseus.
Yeah. Or something. Yeah. It's like, but yeah, yeah. It's just like, it looks just like you. It's got the same, you know, physical organization. And then the question is like, sort of, is that intelligent? Is this creature that's been created, this zombie, they're called zombies. Is the zombie intelligent? Oh, no, sorry. This isn't a zombie. This is the swamp man, is the technical term for it. Zombies are another philosophy of mind thing. That's like,
okay,
zombies are just like you, but they're not conscious.
Right. That has to do with the Chinese room thing.
That's sort of connected to the Chinese room thing, yeah. But the swamp man thing is connected to this thing of some philosophers really think that part of how our brain comes to represent the world, and in some ways this has to be true, I think, but they're saying what's really important for patterns in our brain to mean something is that they arose through evolution, that they evolved in order to be part of the world, you know, and they're sort of caused by, you know, our ancestors encountered this liquid and they consumed it and now we call it water. And the reason our brains really mean water when we're thinking about water is because of evolution, is the idea.
Okay.
This was the last philosophy of mind class I took, I should say. Because after that, I was like, yeah, that's enough, I think. I think I'm good
at this point. Okay, Matt. Wait. I think I can interpret this to make actual sense. So it's like...
Practical sense you can use every day?
Yeah, maybe.
Okay.
So, I've heard that a bee and a flower is like one organism. You know what I mean? Like the bee has evolved with the flower and we have evolved with the flower. You know what I mean? Like, so the bee and the flower could be one organism. I think he's talking about like a swamp thing that just like weirdly assembles cells and all of a sudden it's a Carl or whatever, a Matt or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in a vacuum, right? Or whatever. It didn't evolve with the rest of the earth. Right. So I mean, a lot of it is, I mean, we're getting cosmic here, but it's like the earth and everything on it is kind of like a bunch of systems working together in a perfect world. And, you know, we think we're individuals, but maybe we're not individuals. Maybe we're part of a giant system. Maybe that's what he's talking about. I don't know. That's my
no, totally. That. Yeah. I think that's what they mean. Yeah, that it's you can't just like carve out a person. You can't carve out intelligence from the environment in which it arose. You know, and it's only sort of meaningful in the context of its interactions with everything else in the world.
Totally. Right. Totally. Yeah.
Right. To like bring it back to Art Shed.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the thing, like if you're just creating art and not showing it to anyone, is that still art? Mm. Because there's no interaction with an audience.
I mean, people have said no. I mean,
right. Well, I feel like that's, yeah, I people have said that.
Yes. And like if you write a great play and just nobody has ever seen it and then burn it, is it? And then you drop dead. I mean, did it ever exist? I don't know.
This is really interesting to me as a non-artist. I really love outsider art.
Yes.
And you know, Henry Darger is from here in Chicago, and he's someone who all of that stuff that he did was no one knew about it. It was completely just his own little world. So. Do you think of it as like his work became art the moment it was discovered and shared with people? Is that when it transitioned to art away from whatever it was before?
I mean, personally, I think that like his art, you know, I disagree with the, like, if you're making it, like I personally get a lot of joy out of just making stuff for myself, although I do like sharing it too. But I think it's obvious when you look at Darger's work, he's making that for himself, like as some sort of therapy or some sort of like communication with God or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, like it's something he didn't seem like he had a choice. He had to make it.
Yes. Yeah.
You know?
Certainly seemed to be creating a system of sorts too.
Yeah.
That there were very much, I mean, it comes across kind of as a history, but there seemed to be some sort of really bizarre system in
right.
there. And with a military organization and yeah. but just the worldview itself was very, very unique.
For sure.
Yeah. Yeah, but it became art after people found it, maybe. You know what I mean? Like I think there's a lot of stories like that. I don't know. I'm not saying it's I agree with you, Andy.
Yeah, I kind of like, I don't know, I feel like it's more about, for, you know, being someone who creates things, I feel like at least 50% of the experience is creating it, if not way more.
Right.
You know, and then the other percent is like seeing what happens after you show it to people. So,
yeah,
you know, like that's definitely part of it, is sharing it.
But I would also, another way to think about this too is, and I'm going to keep this in terms of Darger, that
yeah,
the act of making it would change him.
Yeah.
And he interacted with other people.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you said something, you know, a form of therapy for him.
Yeah.
And so if you make something that then changes you, and you are interacting with other people, that is impacting other people.
Right.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's you can't, again, it's like, you can't cleave a person away from the world. Right.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So even, you know, he kept it to himself. Yeah. Right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Andy, that's a good question. And I have no idea, but I tend to think like, if you put it down on paper, okay, here, I'll bring it to a different level, Andy.
Okay.
What if you have an idea for a painting, but you never put it down in a painting?
Right.
Like, you never physically create it in the world. It's just an idea.
Does this bring us back to that artist we were talking about who created an imaginary painting and then sold it?
Yeah. No, but I mean, is that art, dude? Or is the art? What I'm trying to say, I mean, that's good, because he isn't the artist right. who made no painting is or no sculpture is actually interacting with the world. So
right. Yeah. I mean, maybe, yeah. I don't know. I feel like there has to be some sort of interaction. So
that's what I'm saying too.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like if you're just thinking about it, I mean, maybe there's an art to thinking, but it's different. I don't know.
No, I think the act of because how many ideas, sorry, I say.
Oh, that you just lose.
No. How many ideas that you have, and you cannot like execute the idea correctly, but it comes out cool anyway, or different,
yeah.
or like it's like the interaction with the universe, and interaction with the paint, and interaction with the canvas, and you have this great idea, but you just go with the flow, and it comes out different. So you're kind of interacting with nature and materials,
right.
and whatever else. So, so I think that's gonna be it. But I think if you have this idea, like if Darger had all these great ideas and never put them on a paper or canvas, I wouldn't call that art. I would call it like
right.
thinking. I mean, I'm sure there's some.
But what if that affects your choices and stuff like that?
I mean, there's a lot of people who, like, okay, so I paint stuff for people a bunch of times, and they have these ideas, but they don't do art, and they go, Carl, could you paint this for me and do this and that, and they have all these specific ideas, and like I kind of riff off that and do my own thing, but I don't call them the artist. I'm painting
right.
for them, you know,
so right like, totally
so yeah. I think you have to put it on paper or put it on something or do something with it. I think it's the act,
right? But if I'm So to put it another way, though, if I'm work like I work in animation, I work on TV shows that you know, like TV shows, they usually have like a creator, you know,
right?
And but I'm an artist on the show. Mm. Am I just an extension of the creator's
like the great
idea?
Like the great masters who have like 15 people working for them and they right. never did anything.
Yeah, they never get any credit.
right.
I don't know.
Well, I think it is. It's I think with television and with any project where there are a lot of people working to create something, that's yeah. part of why there are titles there. I mean, not just obviously they're there for the process of doing the work, but even on different projects, a person with the same title on two different projects may be doing various things, maybe doing different things. But I was going to say, Andy, you know, you won an Emmy Award for something very specific that you did.
Right.
So while the creator of that show gets credit for the concept, you do get the credit and you are the artist in whatever job, whatever role you're in at that time. That
right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the good thing about working in the television industry or the movie industry is that most of the time you do get credit for your work. It just goes by really quickly.
Right.
And unless you know to look for it, you don't see it, you know, but you know, there are people who like there's like, yeah, like people who work in sculpture who, yeah, like Carl was saying, they have a lot of people working for them, making their sculptures, mass producing their sculptures for them, and they just come up with the ideas.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. But the thing is, I think with a lot of contemporary art too, I think it's more accurate to describe something as being fabricated.
Right.
And, you know, whoever it was who made, say, like the classic example, like the Jeff Koons stainless steel bunny. I mean, yeah. You can take that and say, hey, I made that and you need railings done for your new office building.
Right.
Watch what I you know, I don't know what the people who did that do, but I would imagine that people who can make a giant stainless steel bunny don't then go out and say, hey, you need a stainless steel puppy made? I can do
right.
that. You know, I think that they were, yeah, probably making railings for a office the next day or something.
Totally. I mean, they're craftsmen. I mean, I think you're either,
yeah.
I don't know. Depends. I think to be an artist, you have to have some original idea. Even if you take like somebody who is directing you, but then you go off and do your own original thing off of it. You know, you have to have, you can't just like assemble a table, like according to directions. You're not the
right.
You're a craftsman at that point.
I didn't invent those IKEA pieces of furniture I have in my house, Carl.
Well, it depends on how you assemble them.
I guess that's true.
Yeah. I just heard an interview with Liz Phair that was talking about how she feels like so much of her natural state is so under constrained. There's just so many different ideas she has bubbling around that she's often worked better when it's like being given a certain thing. Like her first album was totally about like, it's like, let's make a song by song response to this album by Rolling Stones. But like, it's not like she then just like copied it, you know, song by song. There was a whole, that was just a spark, just a prompt, right?
Yeah.
So it's like her work wouldn't exist without the pre-existing work, but like it's
right.
It's a totally different thing in the end.
No, Matt, you're totally correct. Like being constrained and having like a structure makes, I think, better art.
Oh yeah, limited palette.
Yeah, totally. You can't just splatter everything on there and, you know.
It's like those drinks you make, Chris. You don't put everything in there.
No, definitely not. No. I mean, he tries sometimes. Yeah,
I'm sure you have tried that at some point.
And nobody's drank it afterwards.
But everything, whether it's drinks or food, as much as possible, I always try and pare things down.
Yeah.
And that there's kind of main components and then accents. Yeah.
So are you basing these off any drinks? in real life, in real world drinks?
I tend to base them on flavors. And I'm sure there are some drinks out there that have these flavors, but I definitely, you know, I do have a lot of experience, decades of experience, of really approaching foods where it's kind of like I taste something, then I grab another a piece of a different type of food that I think might go well with it, and I just put the two of them both in my mouth together and eat them. And it's like, huh, okay. And I'll do that before, say, I come up with, say, putting together apples and rhubarb to make a rub for pork ribs that is then going to go, you know, this is going to take me hours to make that. It's going to have to marinate overnight. I'm going to have to smoke it for 5 hours, blah, blah, blah. But I can just take a piece of rhubarb, a piece of apple, sprinkle some bird's eye chili on it, and throw it in my mouth and see what happens. And I'm not, and it won't taste like that at the end, but I can tell if I'm headed down a really wrong road.
Right.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
And how about like levels of flavor? Do you like somehow deflavor stuff, like strain it or put a whiff of something, you know what I mean? Like, you know, something you don't want too intense. How do you do that?
Yeah. Well, there are the ratios of it. Right. There is, so sticking with this example, do I boil it down or sort of simmer the sauce down to a thicker consistency? Do I then also add it to the ribs after they've been cooked? So in addition to, you know, well, then it becomes a question of, well, do I use this as a marinade and then cook the ribs with that and baste it on as I cook? Or do I do the ribs a totally different way and then add this at the end as a sauce that you only eat after they've been, that you only apply to it after it's been cooked or at the very end? So yeah, I mean, they're just a wide variety of things that you can do just with those, taking those three flavors, and those go well. Well, and it's four too, because you got to include pork in there. Then there's smoke because you're making ribs. So I mean, you've got five things right there.
Does fire make it good?
Yeah, 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 absolutely.
That's the kind of the driving question of a lot of your cooking is, does fire make it good?
It is.
And the answer is yes.
It does. But I mean, I do have to say too, I mean, when I first started getting really into grilling, and this is like 20 years ago, when I started really like trying to break it down, I've been grilling for longer than that. But I started out doing some really stupid stuff. And I didn't understand the importance of contrast. And I was sort of like, I'm going to make everything on the grill just to make it on the grill. So we've got smoked potatoes going with ribs, going with smoked cornbread. And by the end of the whole thing, you're just like, oh my God, no, it's just everything tasted like smoke. And it was just overpowering. Right. Not so much that they were too smoky. Like you could have that smoked cornbread with a salad and be like, wow, this goes really well together because you have a contrast. Or, you know, but you go have it go with something that isn't smoky and then it would be a nice addition to a meal. But when everything was all smoky without the contrast, you couldn't get the flavor, the reward of the good flavor.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's interesting, Chris, this is maybe going back to the Neanderthals again, which is I've always wondered about so many of the inventions of cooking, different cooking technologies by our ancestors, right? Who like there were presumably like oral traditions or whatever, but like someone had to decide like, you know, I'm gonna take this stuff that got infected by something and see what happened. And, oh, it's beer now. That's good. Or, you know,
right,
like,
right.
And what sort of like the mind that approaches, food in that way, like I'm gonna take a few things and stick in my mouth and see if they taste good together, like that's
yeah. And at that level, some of it, you wonder how much of it had to be because of survival,
right.
So it's sort of like, oh my God, all of my grain got wet and it's been sitting there, and that, you know, they're kind of like starving and kind of like, oh, I have this thing of grain, this, you know, big jug of grain that's I buried, let me dig it up. And then it's like, oh, it got wet, oh, it's kind of, well, let's try it. Huh, yeah. This is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And then, wow, this makes me drunk. you know,
I'm thinking the same thing with yogurt. Like,
yeah.
Oh, I have this milk that's gone bad.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, it's fermented. I guess. I think maybe they like Neanderthals and ancient peoples were just a lot smarter than we give them credit for.
Oh, yeah. For sure.
Well, especially with yogurt. Yogurt and cheese, the main purpose of those was to preserve dairy.
Right.
Because if you just take milk and you just carry it around with you, at the end of the day, say you're walking across the savannah or something, or the desert, or anywhere that isn't cold, and yeah, that milk is not going to be good.
Yeah.
By the end of that day, you're not going to want to drink that.
Yeah, it's a lot of trial and error.
Yeah, but if you take that and you make cheese out of it, if you take that and you make yogurt, you have something that is going to last a lot longer.
The weird thing, though, is a lot of fermented foods are like some of the best foods for you, too. So they really like had their shit going on good, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, but part of it too is, I mean, you can look at it two ways. One is to say, oh, they found something that was really good for them. The other thing is to say that we evolved.
Right.
Because that's what we could make and what we had to live on. And so the people who did not benefit from these foods that were, you know, basic, that were pickled or whatever, fermented, those people didn't survive because that's what there was to live on. That's what there was. And you either evolved to benefit from that or you died.
That's the other part is you're, you know, the whole thing of we're saying we're individuals, but your whole GI system is a bunch of microbes.
Right.
You know, that may be controlling you or not, you know? are you just a puppet for your microbes? You know, that's another strange thing. Matt, you guys study that, like the gut?
I study it as someone who has gut issues. I've become very personally concerned with the gut-brain interactions, and I take antidepressants for my gut, so my gut isn't so depressed. It's another one of those great things, you know, as a scientist, like people ask me like, oh yeah. So like you guys have like figured out the brain and language, right? Like you're done with that.
Yeah.
Like, no, we don't know anything. Like we're still working on it. And then I go to the doctor and I'm like,
right.
Hey, I don't feel good. You know, the answer to this, right? And it turns out the answer there is like, well, we're still figuring it out. In one situation, I really like being on the frontiers of human knowledge, and in other cases, I am not so excited to be on the frontiers of human knowledge.
No, it's like a peek behind the curtain. Like we really don't know a ton, you know. Like it's like a lot of trial and error, you know, to this day. So I have another. Oh, do you want to speak to that? Sorry.
No. Go ahead. Go ahead.
I have another thing for you, which. I don't know, like in my quest for looking up different weird things like the Chinese room and stuff like that for your interview, I don't know if this might be like totally off base from neuroscience, but I can just put it out there anyway, and you can comment on it. Have I brought up this David Lewis? So David Lewis is a physicist, right? And he thinks that a person is four-dimensional, right? So this will bring up, I mean, like, so describe a four-dimensional person. You have to kind of talk about Doctor Who a little bit. So Doctor Who had, you know, there's been like six different doctors, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like the original Doctor Who was like an old guy and his daughter, right? And like wandering around.
Granddaughter.
His granddaughter, right? Yeah. An old guy and his granddaughter, and it was in black and white, and it was like slow. And then there was like another Doctor Who that was like this good-looking Doctor Who with a sidekick who was a pretty woman, and there was like all these great, you know, special effects. It's the same show, but has nothing to do with the other one, right? So it's all slices, right? So Doctor Who is like a series, right? So you would say it's the same series. It's the same thing as when you were a kid, you know, every 7 years you've evolved into a completely different person. And you know, besides like your experiences connecting you, you might not be the same person. So what Davis Lewis is saying is that your whole, like the fourth part of your life is time, right? So you're not a full person until the day you die. Then you become a person. I mean, I guess that's a
nice,
right?
It's funny you brought that up, because I was thinking when you started talking about gut bacteria, I was going to bring up the fact that, like, isn't it like it takes 7 years for all your cells to be replaced?
Right.
So you're like a new person. And I feel like if you look back on your life, like there are times when you're in like different headspaces. And I feel like that kind of tends to, I haven't figured it out, but that tends to coincide with like, it takes a long time. Like I've been in headspaces for a long time. And then when I finally get out of them, I feel like a different person.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like my brain is working completely differently. And it's like I've been through periods where I've been depressed or super nervous or, you know, like really anxious. And then like when I finally get out of that, I'm like, wow, like I look at the world completely differently. I translate everything differently. Like when people say stuff to me, I translate, like, when I was in a bad place, I translated everything completely the wrong way. Funny. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
Totally. Definitely. Yeah. I mean, it's the one sort of reaction to this that you see is, this is like where like more Buddhist philosophers are like, yeah, that's why the self is not a thing. I mean, there's not, you're a different person at all these different points in time. And so, maybe what you need to get rid of is the, you know, idea of this thing that's persisting across this time. Maybe there's not anything that's persisting. There's this constant change that happens over time.
Yeah. And there's a whole thing too. I mean, it's your view of yourself changes. And
sure.
One way to look at it is, you know, we kind of think this is who I am. But if you were to describe, say, just pick a year in your life and you were to say, or a couple years and say, the time that from when you were 17 to 19 and when you were 22, if you were to write a history of that year, what would that be? And then 5 years later, you were to write it down again. And then 5 years later, do it again. And it's kind of like every single story, when you look back at your life, the meaning of the things that were important that happened to you and that you recall will change over time. And it's kind of your entire life is almost like it's historical fiction.
Yeah.
The facts are all the same.
Right.
But the story changes. The narrative, the meaning of all of it will change, even though the events didn't.
Right.
Just like in English, the last word in a sentence changes the meaning of the whole sentence. Like, if I say, I love you, or if I say I love flowers, that sentence is completely freaking different. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And so your whole life is different because of the meaning you put on it at the end, maybe. I don't know.
Right. And you can even expand it further and be like you have all these different versions of yourself through a time, but then there's also the versions of yourself that other people see. Like I know I've known Carl my entire life. I'm sure Carl's view of who I am is completely different than my personal view.
I thought you were a nerd the entire time. Oh, I thought you said my...
you're right, Carl. It is exactly the same.
Pots and kettles, Carl. That's all I got to say.
Anyway, Matt, I'm sorry. I want you to... Do you have any... weird comments on anything. It doesn't even have to be on the weird fucking four-dimensional person. I don't know if you can really, if anybody could really comment on that or whatever you want to talk about.
I just, you know, I mean, kind of the reason I was mentioning the Buddha stuff is there is this whole kind of school of cognitive science that got kind of really wrapped up in that thinking that there were lots to learn from Buddhist psychology about how to conceptualize the mind. And this sort of links back, actually, we were talking about way earlier of inventing new things, you know, and part of it is like, in this case, not maybe inventing, but that you have a different conceptual framework, you know, you bring to like thinking about what it means to be a person. And even does the term person make any sense? You know, so
right.
That's something that like up until there was that contact with those traditions in a Western tradition, it was like, well, of course there's a person. The problem is how do we figure out how all those different Doctor Who series connect together into one single thing, you know, that's, and so that's been this really cool dialogue. You know, the Dalai Lama is, the current Dalai Lama is very interested in science and is very interested in the science of the mind. And so it's been there's been these really cool dialogues that have happened with, he actually invited a whole bunch of cognitive scientists to come to see him in India. And there was a collection of essays on that. And then they have this whole thing called the Mind and Life Foundation that's been sponsoring research related to that. And so it's still a marginal sort of trend in the field. It's still very Western sort of thinking dominated. And So I don't have any good solutions to that. Most of my work is like we don't talk about consciousness at all, which is a little weird given that we're talking about intelligent beings. You're kind of thinking about consciousness as being kind of part and parcel of that, but we just pretend to be like, no, that's not a thing. Don't worry about that.
The elephant in the room, man.
Yeah. We just love to talk about the unconscious. Like that's most of what we study is all the unconscious things. And then we just shove aside all of those other ideas. And
unconscious how? Like
so like I study, you know, so if you have a thought and you want to express it, I mean, my kind of, what that feels like to me is I open my mouth and start talking. Like, I don't feel like there's a lot of things happening. It's just there's thoughts. Sometimes I can't find the right word, let's say. But once I know which word I want to say, I just say it. But it turns out there's all these different complex steps that are involved in doing that. Like, once you remember which word you want to, you know, select a word you want to talk about, you have to remember what sounds are in those words. Then you have to actually plan out how you're going to move your muscles to actually execute those sounds. And those are things that can actually break down in if you have brain damage or something like that. So there's a lot of stuff under the hood, you know, that we just sort of float on top of. You can think about all the other, you know, I study language, but it's true of so many different things. Like, we don't sit around and think like, okay, got to breathe now. Okay, got to breathe again. Yeah, you know that. Or you stand up and walk. You just walk. There's no conscious thinking about how am I going to move my muscles in the right way to do that. So that's where we kind of mine that part of the unconscious. It's the stuff that's kind of like just invisible to us and to our consciousness, right? We don't even think about it as being a particularly difficult problem. It's just something we do. So, yeah.
So do you think apes or whatever, or humans became intelligent because of language?
Language makes a whole lot of stuff a lot easier, I think, is what I would say seems to be true of it. It does seem to be the case, like when you look at development, like once kids can use words to refer to things, that helps with abstraction we were talking about earlier. Like once you know there's a word glass that can refer to any glass, it's not like there's one word for my bottle, there's another word for this glass, all of them refer to the same type of thing.
Right.
You can like think about things very generally. And that's a kind of, you know, inside of us, like a cognitive revolution that happens inside every child. You know, they are like, whoa, yeah. I can totally think about the world this way. This is amazing, yeah. You know, and then they can, that just enables much more complex thought. And yeah, so that's, and then the other thing it's really good at is talking about things that aren't in the environment too. That's where, okay. Like, even if there's not a glass around, I can say the word glass and you know what I'm talking about. And like, we can talk to each other across the internet and the words all make sense, even though we're not like looking at the same things in the yeah. same environment. Mm-hmm. And so those are pretty powerful things, you yeah. know, that's yeah. then yeah. right. there you got like oral tradition right there. And
right.
you can transmit knowledge right. to kids without having yeah. to be like, to walk them through everything. You know, well, there's
this sort of makes me think, though, that, you know, you're saying that you don't deal with consciousness, and that's kind of the elephant in the room, the thing you mm-hmm. just sort of say, we aren't looking at that and everything. But in a sense, aren't you kind of doing that with, you're doing something different with looking at kind of the acquisitions of behaviors, skills, so on and so forth.
Yeah.
With something like that, and that is, do you see a breakdown when you're looking at stuff? Do you try to differentiate between, maybe these are the wrong words to describe it, but say innate versus acquired?
Yeah, that's a huge, that's like a huge thing that people spend a lot of time trying to figure okay. out what's innate and what's acquired. And people, yeah, there's, it's, and it's something where people can do really amazing things that it seems like, how could they know how to do this? They must've been born knowing how to do things. And
right.
And people are born knowing how to do all sorts of crazy things. If you think about just things like infants are attracted to objects that look like faces.
Right.
When they come out of the womb, they're like, give me a face. Where's a face? Where is it at? Mm-hmm. You know, and that seems like a pretty complex thing to like be able to orient towards those yeah. types of things. Yeah. So we know like certain things can be built in, but how much of it is built in? How much do you learn? How much is sort of culturally determined?
Yeah.
That's like, yeah. that's like basically like 90% of developmental research, I'd say, is like really focused
yeah.
on that.
Yeah.
And there, I think this is where technology has really changed our thinking on a lot of things. Cause you know, it seemed like computers are really dumb, you know, artificial intelligence really wasn't happening. So it must be that there's a lot of stuff built in, but now that things are with massive amounts of data, we can see that computers can actually do quite a bit that at least looks right. intelligent, you know, or it seems pretty complicated. Like they've figured out pretty complex things.
Yeah.
I guess I put like figured out in quotes, like they can exhibit behaviors that make it look like they've learned something very complex. And there's like kids experience a lot in the world. And we don't know, like there's, if you think about all the seconds that transpire in a year, you know, that kid is getting information all of that time. And that's shaping how right. their brain works. And so now people have been doing a lot of things to try and really get a closer look at what data do kids actually get. This one scientist wired up his whole home and basically recorded all language that his son was exposed to in the first 5 years of his life.
Oh my God. I love to be that kid.
I know. Jeez. Yeah. Do not be a child of a cognitive scientist. It's like a bad.
Yeah. That sounds like a bad mix.
Yeah. I mean, there's all this like privacy things they were controlling for. And you like, it's not like you can just download this data. Like you have to go to the guy and talk to him and
right.
figure out, you know, analysis can be run. Anyway, sorry.
Oh, that's kind of par for the course. Doesn't everybody record everything their kid does for the first 5 years?
Well, the first kid, at least.
Right.
By the
yeah, right.
yeah.
Yeah.
Wait. Is Carl or Andy the older one? I can't remember.
Carl's older, but he comes after Christine.
We didn't record anything.
No.
I mean, I'm talking about modern.
We had like photos.
Yeah,
right.
Okay. I'm talking about modern parents with the technology that we have now.
Yeah, well, isn't that what you're doing? Like you've installed spyware on all your kids' phones, and, you know, everything they're exposed to. Like,
yeah, no.
You don't have to record your kids nowadays at all. Just ask Google.
That's right. They've already surrendered it already. Yes.
No, but you know what is it, like the thing is, you ask your kid, they tell you nothing, but then, but now, like, I love seeing my kids, like, they write a journal, and they do, my boy writes a journal, and he does, like drawings in there and stuff, and I got to see, I was just, look, before this episode, I was actually going through it, because it's the end of the school year, and I was just checking it out, and it was really cool, because, like, and it's a lot of stuff we did as a family, like, going to the beach, going on a boat, doing cool stuff, and he, like, at the time, you know, going apple picking, you know what I mean, doing fun stuff. And like stuff I make the kids do, but they kind of like me making them do like fun stuff. I'm like, let's do it. Otherwise, they'd just sit around and play video games, you know?
Right. Yeah.
You know, so I think this is probably the end of the, around the end of the episode. We went a little over, but I thought, I think we have like a couple things I need to cut out anyway. So,
okay.
I think this is a good one, man.
Yeah,
it's always fun chatting with you guys.
Yeah,
great.
Yeah, this will be a great one. Matt, obviously, you don't want to tell us your links, or do you have a link or anything? Or
you can just leave my links out.
Yeah, that's fine. Stay away from my links. Chris, what are you?
Livefire Cook on Instagram, livefirecook.com. Livefire Cook, Livefire Cook.
Hashtag live fire cook.
Hashtag live fire cook. Backslash live fire cook.
Andy?
Yeah, I'm at andyristaino.com. That's R-I-S-T-A-I-N-O. And you can find links to my Twitter and Instagram and Tumblr and all sorts of other things. YouTube.
I'm madcarl.com, madsparrow.com, Carl on Instagram, Carl on Facebook. And you don't have to stay here, but get the hell out of the bar.
Thanks to Matt for being on the show and talking to us. Thanks to Carl and Chris for helping host the show. Thanks to Andy Sinispago and Ed Guild for the Mad Carl Stomp. Thanks to Mark Rossano for helping edit some of the shows. Thanks to all our listeners for tuning in and sticking around to hear the credits. I'm sure you're all still listening. You probably don't all just shut off the podcast right as Carl kicks you out of the shed. You're probably hanging around the shed a little longer, hopefully. Anyway. Yeah, have a good week, everyone.